Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Sheriff Lee Baca answers calls for his resignation. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. In the aftermath of reports about continuing brutal violence by deputies in LA County jails, the ACLU and others have called on the sheriff to resign his elected office. Tonight we'll hear Baca in a lengthy exchange with the ACLU's lead attorney. Are inmates being badly mistreated even when they're mentally ill? Has Baca been insulated from reports of what's really going on? Later on, does Occupy Wall Street have a future? First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Occupy Wall Street is getting increased attention with arrests in Boston early this morning and a march to the Upper East Side in New York today. Is it a resurgence of America's left? Does it have the staying power to make a difference? We'll talk about that later on. First, Los Angeles County Sheriff Lee Baca. 2 weeks ago, he told Which Way LA he was not in denial about violence by deputies in LA County jails, but he said he'd already looked into cases reported by the ACLU and others. Since then, he has promised to re-examine cases of alleged abuse and to improve inmate safety. One especially disturbing incident, reported by the LA Times, involved a highly regarded rookie deputy who resigned after he says a supervisor forced him to beat a mentally ill inmate in Twin Towers. That's the jail where mentally ill inmates are kept. Sheriff Baca, welcome as always to Which Way LA.
Thank you, Warren.
You're an elected official. Since this flood of reports about deputies and abuse in the jails, there have been calls for you to resign. What's your response?
Well, my response is simply that the voters will have to make that decision. And I think that at this point, there are so many people who have various points of view about the problem in the jail. And I appreciate what the ACLU has done. And they've provided me with a further need to further examine what we're doing. But we have a democracy in this county, and I think that that democracy has to make that decision.
Tell us more about the re-examination that you have ordered of these various cases raised by the ACLU and by others as well.
Well, I think the cases that are presented by the ACLU certainly have to be investigated. We are doing that. I have a 35-man task force, and women are involved in this. And we're examining all of the allegations to the extent possible. It would have been nice if I had been receiving these allegations as they emerged, because it makes it more difficult now with inmates moving away from our custody into the streets, and all the witnesses are scattered about. But we're going to do this the best of our ability nonetheless.
Do you have more than one investigation underway?
I have dozens of investigations underway. We've kind of triaged the ACLU report for those that are the most severe allegations. And obviously, they could be, if we were able to find the evidence, that there could be possible criminal prosecutions for deputies who created transgressions. But at this point, we're well on our way, and we're meeting weekly with the board, that is, and accounting for what we do, the Office of Fed Review is involved. We intend to pass the cases up to the U.S. Attorney's Office for their review and consideration. And if the U.S. Attorney thinks that more could be done with the FBI's investigative capabilities, then that's fine with me.
The FBI is already investigating. At one point, you objected to that. You're now cooperating with the FBI?
Well, I've never objected to the FBI doing what they're doing. What I objected to is the phone that was introduced in the jail, which is a misdemeanor, and the FBI's training bulletin for all police officers around the United States and sheriffs is that phones are the most dangerous contraband in jail. That's how inmates plan plots for a variety of reasons. But in this case, this phone, we've checked it already, was essentially benign in terms of any other problem. They were just merely calling the FBI.
Again, Lee Baca, Los Angeles County Sheriff, stay with us. Peter Eliasberg is legal director for the ACLU of Southern California, which has been monitoring the jails in Los Angeles County for 36 years as a result of the Rutherford case, which gave the ACLU that right and that opportunity. Peter Eliasberg, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
You've been one of those who's called for the sheriff to resign. What do you say to what he's saying now, first about that and the need for democracy in Los Angeles County, second about his plans for investigations?
Well, I think I want to put that call for resignation in context. I've never said that that would be the solution to the epidemic of deputy on inmate abuse in the jails. What I have said is that we have reported, we the ACLU as well as others have reported to the Sheriff's Department and to their council numerous times over numerous years that these problems exist and exist in a serious way in the jails. And until about a week ago, the response we've gotten from the Sheriff's Department, Sheriff Baca himself and his spokesperson has been, the ACLU exaggerates, prisoners lie, we investigate all of this carefully, and basically none of it's true, or if any of it's true, you know, it's just one or two cases, and we appropriately discipline inmates. So the reason we called for Sheriff Baca's resignation is that these are not new allegations and new problems, and yet for year after year, what we've got is being scoffed at by the Sheriff's Department and his spokesperson. So we don't think that the sheriff has shown himself willing or capable of, and with the people that he has underneath him, of taking on these problems and addressing them. Now, you know, it's nice to see that the sheriff is saying, well, we appreciate and we're grateful for the ACLU's report, but a week ago he was holding a press conference in which he was scoffing at the report and saying, we have many more allegations of abuse than this, and the ACLU has nothing here. So this about-face seems to me in large part driven by the fact that, you know, Steve Lopez from the LA Times is calling for his resignation, the FBI is investigating, and the jails are a national embarrassment, and the story is spread over every newspaper in the country.
The sheriff just indicated that I think he indicated, he can speak for himself, that this is all coming into coming to his attention rather quickly. He has to deal with it all at once. People have moved away and been released from jail, and it's very difficult to assemble the evidence.
Well, but the reality is we sent a report, we did a report 18 months ago that had allegations, significant number of allegations of abuse, and the Sheriff's Department spokesperson was on your program, Warren, saying, oh, well, we like the ACLU, but we don't appreciate their misstatements and exaggerations. And so the sheriff and his department had an opportunity 18 months ago to look into these things, but apparently they did nothing about them. And we've been reporting problems, and Merrick Bobb has been reporting problems, have been in the jail for years. So I don't see how this could possibly be becoming as sort of something new and fast to the sheriff and his department unless the sheriff has insulated himself from any kind of decent reporting from the custody division of his department. And as far as the investigations are concerned, I mean, the reality is that their previous mantra has always been, we investigate everything thoroughly. Yet when we put out a report and we show that three civilian eyewitnesses who've witnessed numerous incidents in the jails, a jail's chaplain particularly, and a jail's volunteer who tutored inmates in the jails, they were never once talked to by either Sheriff's Department personnel or the Office of Independent Review. So if you have an incident of force in the jails and nobody bothers to interview a civilian eyewitness who deputies knew were there and sergeants knew were present for that, then that's an investigation that even Inspector Clouseau would be embarrassed about. So I think it's kind of odd for the sheriff to say now, well, boy, the ACLU should have brought this to my attention earlier. He should have in place a robust investigation system, but he doesn't.
Sheriff Baca, back to you. Are you, in fact, insulated from these kinds of reports?
No, I'm not. However, I will say this in defense of what I just heard said. I am now concerned about what I've just heard, and I would offer that I go to the meetings with the ACLU and hear it for myself so we can close the gap. There's no question that some information I've missed. I don't doubt that. But at the same time, I think we can improve this situation. I disagree with the characterizations that I scoffed at the report. In the onset of my discovery of a telephone into the system, that was my primary consideration at that moment. And a couple weeks later, the ACLU releases its report. That's well and good. But I was very, very clear, and I would ask that the record be straight, that I have never said anything to the extent that this report is not important. And where that comes from, well, I just heard it by spokespeople. But I cannot be held purely blameless with whatever messaging is going into the ACLU. So the only thing I can do at this point and say to the gentleman on the phone is that you and I need to get together, and you need to tell me what your frustrations are, and I'm willing to address them directly.
You're saying now that as a result of what you just heard from Peter Eliasberg, you're going to go to meetings with the ACLU in its capacity as a monitor of the jails?
That's correct. And if he welcomes that, then I think we can get a lot accomplished. But I'm not a person that is an anti-civil rights person. In fact, to the contrary, I had a great relationship with Ramona Ripson when she was running the show. I expect to have a great relationship even today. But there's a reality that there is a problem in jail. Let's get busy with that. And yet, at the same time, I can only act on facts. You know, and if I have to be guilty of any kind of criticizing something, it's the fact that I can't come to a determination unless I have the evidence. But we do take the allegations seriously. We are looking at every aspect of it, and we have a track to be accountable within, and we also have a track to be accountable to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I'm not adverse to a pattern and practice inquiry. I think that's important, too. I've been around these jails for a long, long time, way back when John Hager was monitoring for the ACLU. I just would like to see a little more of the ACLU representatives coming in, not less.
Peter Eliasberg, what do you say to that? Are you welcoming what the sheriff is now saying about his relationship with your organization?
Well, you know, I would be more open to it, Warren, if the fact was if year after year we hadn't filed these reports and gotten nothing from department spokespeople and the chief of his custody division saying, oh, we've even looked at everything the ACLU said and none of them was true. And then when we turn back the rock and find out that his investigations consist of not even interviewing civilian eyewitnesses to deputy abuse or allegations of deputy abuse, it's a little hard to take it seriously that now the sheriff finally is willing to meet with us and talk with us and get to the bottom of this. He's had years and years and years of opportunity to get to the bottom of this, and instead all we've ever gotten from his spokesperson, from him, and from the chief of the custody division is, oh, this is all exaggerations from the ACLU and prisoners lie.
Won't it make a difference if the sheriff himself, though, as he indicates he wants to be, is directly involved?
Well, I'm certainly willing to meet with the sheriff and talk about these issues, but I think given the sordid history of the failure of the department and, frankly, the failure of the Board of Supervisors to take any kind of aggressive role into looking into what we've been pointing to for years and years, and not just us, but Merrick Bobb, who's the counsel to the Board of Supervisors, you know, I'm willing to do that, but I don't think that I remotely think that that would be enough. And I'm also surprised that Sheriff Baca is saying that the only objection he had to the FBI was the issue of the cell phone. I mean, he said to the LA Times, what kind of experience do they have in dealing with this? What do they know about the policies and procedures and the law? And we police ourselves. So the fact was he didn't just have a problem with the FBI bringing a cell phone in. He suggested that the FBI was not competent to look into these issues and, quote, we police ourselves. Well, when we find out that the policing ourselves consists of investigations where inmates who report being assaulted by deputies are interviewed for the force investigation with the assaulting deputy in the room with them, that's not an investigation. Vic Mackey of the Shield would run a more honest investigation than his sheriff's department has been running of allegations of abuse in the jails.
I just want to say one thing about the cell phone for our listeners to clarify that. The FBI, in fact, smuggled a cell phone into an inmate informer using a deputy who has since resigned. Apparently, he was paid to do that. Sheriff Baca, back to you and your response to what we just heard from Peter Eliasberg.
Well, I can appreciate his feelings, and I think that's more important. The facts are a little widely described, indicating, accounting for what I say to him. And let me say this. The FBI, my admonitions about we police ourselves is not a statement that the public doesn't have a role to play and the ACLU doesn't have a role to play in the Office of Independent Review and others. It's the fact that it takes training to understand what the rights are of deputies. This isn't just a one-sided story, inmates alone. There are two sides or more of the story. It takes a while to get all this pulled together. The FBI, my friend Steve Martinez, who had it, he has four people that I'm aware of that are assigned to this probe that he was doing. It takes more than four people to get to the questions raised by by the ACLU. You got to have a comprehensive staff of trained investigators when it comes to deputy misconduct. We fired seven or eight people in the last couple of years, many for the use of force. What I'm asking for the ACLU to do is not only giving me all the bad news, but how about saying something nice about the Sheriff's Department for a change? Or is this something that is impossible to achieve, no matter how vast the Sheriff's Department is? Isn't it just the jails that I have responsibility for? I've got 4 million people, 11 million people on the Homeland Security front, a huge amount of transportation responsibilities with the Metropolitan Transit Authorities, and I agree. I need to do more. I am doing it. I'm listening to inmates, listening to ACLU, listening to as many people as I can, and I have problems. But that doesn't mean that the ACLU should just jump to the head of the class and say they speak for all of the 11 million people in Los Angeles County and say the sheriff should resign. There are many people that feel otherwise.
I want to go on to another guest, but Peter Eliasberg, the sheriff has directly asked you a question. What about all of the other things that he has to do? Can you, as he put it, to say something nice?
Well, you know, Warren, our job is we have a lawsuit that gives us a role of monitoring and going into the jails. I don't purport to be James Colts doing a comprehensive report about everything that's going on in the Sheriff's Department. We have praised Sheriff Baca for some of the work he's done in a variety of different areas. I certainly think that some of the things he says are great. I think he has expressed a progressive view about the role of law enforcement that's very appropriate. But the reality is that what we do and what I focus on and have been focused on for the last few years is looking at what's happening in the jails. And that's what I have focused on, and that's what I see, and I see an epidemic of problems in the jails, and I have seen from the chief of custody basically a response that everything's fine, we're doing everything just great, and the ACLU and prisoners exaggerate and make this stuff up. So I'm not going to praise the sheriff for that response, but there are other areas where the ACLU has praised the sheriff, and it's true. He has a very large department, but custody is a hugely important portion of what his department does, and as Tom Parker, who was the former number two in charge of the FBI field office out here, after an exhaustive look at the jails and the material and a variety of materials about the jail, says this is the worst jail or prison in the country in terms of deputy on inmate abuse. That's not something I can praise Sheriff Baca for.
Let me introduce Celeste Freeman, who's editor and reporter for WitnessLA.com. That's a very well-respected blog about criminal justice, about gangs, and about law enforcement. Celeste Freeman, thank you very much for being on our program.
It's great to be here, Warren.
You have raised questions about the individuals that the sheriff has put in charge of this reexamination, particularly the undersheriff, Paul Tanaka. What's your problem?
Well, we were very happy to see that the sheriff has come around and finally is focusing on this. I mean, Sheriff Baca has been a very progressive law enforcement figure, and you know, in terms of reentry and rehabilitation, he's been way out ahead of the pack. That's why it's been so perplexing that that the situation in the jails has been allowed to fester, and there's a lot more. I mean, you know, that has yet to be reported on. So, while we welcomed the 35-person investigative task force that he's just appointed, the person who was put as the head of it is Undersheriff Paul Tanaka, as you said. And what we found from a Sheriff's Department insider, and we were able to confirm, is that in 2006, then Assistant Sheriff, now Undersheriff Tanaka, stood in the way of reform at Men's Central Jail, which has been the jail that has had the most problems in terms of alleged abuse of inmates by deputies. The then commanding officer who was running Men's Central Jail, Captain Clark, wanted to put into place shift rotation that would break up these deputy gangs that he felt were responsible for huge spikes in excessive use of force by deputies. He came to Undersheriff Tanaka, and Tanaka reversed his decision and stood in the way of this reform, and then transferred the captain to a completely out of custody division, thereby undercutting the authority of the head of the jails. And thus there was no reform, and the upshot is what we're seeing now, is this culture of violence and abuse has been allowed to flourish. And so we'd like to see the sheriff apply the leadership that he's applied in other areas of the sheriff's department. But frankly, at this point, while it's very nice to have the sheriff's department investigate itself, it just cannot be done without some outside intervention. So we're hoping to see the FBI's probe expanded a great deal. I think that some of the people on a federal level are starting to believe that it needs to be expanded, but it remains to be seen. The other alternative, an additional alternative that the LA Times called for today and we had talked about actually in the spring is having an independent civilian commission a la the Christopher Commission appointed by the Board of Supervisors to investigate and then make recommendations in addition to whatever the Department of Justice is doing and the FBI is doing.
Christopher Commission, of course, involved with the Los Angeles Police Department in the aftermath of the Rodney King incident.
Absolutely. And
let me get back to Sheriff Buck on this.
But there appears to be no money for it.
Okay. Sheriff, what do you say to what we have just heard? Particularly, you said earlier that you'd be okay with a pattern and practice investigation. What about an outside commission? What about the undersheriff as the leader, given the history that Celeste Freeman has just related?
Well, let's deal with the undersheriff. I looked into that myself. I probably wouldn't have done that. What was the issue is that there was a group of deputies, a small group on one floor, that were the problem. And so in order to equalize the solution, the captain decided to transfer all work staff posts of deputies in a configuration that everybody's got to work 2 months in a new job. And also in one of the three shifts, but they can move from shift to shift. So he was going to virtually cause for a total configuration of movement for the sake of the nine people that were, or nine or more or less, that were the problem people under our own suspicious form of looking at things and patterns and so forth. But we didn't have a hard case against even the nine. So the theory was, if everyone's moving, no one gets insulated into one location and become somewhat inbred and therefore become like a clique or, as the gang comment is made, a gang. So the undersheriff at the time was the assistant sheriff. He said, you can't punish them all for the sake of the few. And so he was looking at a labor relations issue, which the union would have quickly imposed on us, because we didn't have any evidence of the cause for the moves in the first place. That wasn't really the reason the captain was moved. It was another element of bringing in a captain who ended up modernizing the look of the inside of the old central jail and cleaned it all up with the help of the deputies. Now, moving away from that into the civilian oversight process, I don't oppose that. You see, I've said since the beginning, I have nothing to hide. The good, the bad, and the ugly should be exposed. But at the same time, there is a value in having, say, the president of the State Bar Association, a number of law school, maybe Ms. Levinson from Loyola University, but somebody that can look at this thing with fresh eyes, that is not an advocate for the Sheriff's Department, not an advocate for the ACLU, but looks at things from the perspective of fresh eyes. And so at that point, I'm open to that idea. I also would like what I'd call community monitors, volunteers. The average citizen should be involved, where they can come into jail at any time and have that authority to just walk around and see for themselves. I'd like more ACLU representatives, interns or otherwise, to come in and look around, because I do believe the deputies need to understand that they must be accountable not just to me, but they have to be accountable to the principles of respect, the principles of our core values, and definitely our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and civil rights. So I think when I meet with the ACLU representatives, and they can call for that meeting immediately if they want, I want to make my own case. I don't need intermediaries. I don't need anyone speaking for me on this issue. I need to speak for myself.
Okay. We are also we have about 30 seconds left, Sheriff. Would you consider changing the system whereby the first assignment the deputies get is in the jail? That seems to a lot of people to be something that leads to cliques, leads to this kind of abuse, and then becomes part of their careers as they go on into other assignments.
I am open to that. I discussed that with the board members today. I think it's, now's the time to look at the two-track model. I know there are custody assistants who would like to be deputies, but they don't go into the patrol environment. And then there are new deputies that would rather not go to patrol either. So I think now's the time. But today the board is reviewing a new jail reconstruction plan. And I left a message there at the ACLU about that. Because we need to tear the building down. It's just a matter of it's too old, and therefore inmates are deserving of a better housing facility.
All right. Thank you all very much. We'll certainly pursue these issues. Lee Baca, Los Angeles County Sheriff, Peter Eliasberg, Legal Director for the ACLU in Southern California, Celeste Freeman with WitnessLA.com. Many thanks to you all.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
Thanks, Warren.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, does Occupy Wall Street have a future on Which Way LA? Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Occupy Wall Street has spread to Boston, where Mayor Thomas Menino ordered arrests early this morning, even though he says he agrees with the protesters' issues. In New York today, the action moved from Lower Manhattan to the Upper East Side. Justin Elliott has been covering the story for Salon.com. And Justin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to be here.
Okay, some noise in the background there. Tell us what's been going on this morning.
Yeah, well, I'm up on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. As most people probably know, it's one of the most exclusive, expensive neighborhoods in Manhattan. There's a march. It's still going on, hitting the homes of some of the richest people in the city and the country, including Rupert Murdoch, you know, owner of News Corp, David Koch, the conservative billionaire. This is a march that's partly folks from Occupy Wall Street and partly folks from some sort of liberal New York community groups who are focusing on state-level issues of economic justice more than sort of the national issues that Occupy Wall Street is focused on. So, yeah, I mean, this thing, it's still growing here.
We can hear the noise in the background, but we can't hear what people are saying. Do they have particular slogans? Are they shouting at one billionaire or another?
Yeah, well, when we were outside Rupert Murdoch's building, somebody screamed up that she wanted a croissant and asked if he could bring her one. But the typical chants here are, we are the 99%, which is sort of the informal slogan of the movement that obviously refers to, you know, income inequality in this country. I see some people with signs defining the 99%, which I believe is if you make less than $1.3 million a year, then you are in the bottom 99% of the country. Another popular one is we got sold out, banks got bailed out. They stopped at the building where Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan, lives. That's sort of another popular one is how do we fix the deficit in the wars, tax the rich. So that gives you a taste of what the message is here.
How are things going at Occupy Wall Street headquarters down in Zuccotti Park? The mayor has said they can stay there indefinitely. I understand they set up a daycare center.
That's right, yeah. Actually, yesterday, Mayor Bloomberg, who has been consistently critical of the protests, finally came out and said that the protests can stay in the park, which is a couple blocks north of Wall Street, for as long as they want. It's technically owned by a private real estate corporation, but there's an ordinance that says it has to be open to the public, so the marchers sort of lucked out on that front. So I think Bloomberg is probably hoping at this point that once the weather starts getting a little bit colder, the whole thing will just peter out. But for now, it's actually unseasonably warm the last couple of days. It's in the 70s here in New York, which is unusual for mid-October. The crowd in the park just keeps growing. The number of people sleeping there keeps growing. I mean, I've been going there for the last 3 weeks since soon after it started. Started pretty small. Now there was talk yesterday when I was there last night about trying to find a new space because there's just too many people. I mean, there's people, unemployed people coming from all over the country, attracting a lot of attention from tourists. So I think this thing is still sort of on the upward slope.
Tell us how they're responding to some of the political reaction we've been hearing. Eric Cantor, the majority leader in the House, saying that this is mob protest. The candidate for president saying that this is an un-American, that kind of reaction. Then the Democrats are sounding sympathetic, and the Congressional Campaign Committee is actually openly supportive.
Yeah, I think what I've heard from interviewing a lot of the people who are sleeping in the park and taking part in these protests is deep skepticism about both parties. There's some fear among some of the people who are involved as organizers about the Democratic Party coming in and trying to somehow co-opt it, if that's even possible. I mean, I don't think that's happened yet. But, I don't think anyone who goes down to Zuccotti Park and takes in the scene can really call this a mob. I mean, it's really a pretty good cross section of American society. I wrote a piece yesterday about some parents, working people who come with their children. As you said, there's now like a little daycare area of the park with crayons and so on. There's unemployed people, there's students, there are, some sort of hippie types and a few anarchists. But look, I mean, it's been incredibly peaceful. I don't think anyone's accused these protesters in New York of violence. So I think that criticism is off base, and I don't think anyone in the park is really taking it too seriously.
Okay, Justin Elliott, once again, reporter for Salon.com, with the Millionaires March on the Upper East Side of New York. Todd Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia. His latest book is The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election. From 1963 to 1964, he was president of Students for a Democratic Society, for people who remember that era. And Todd Gitlin, it's good to have you back on our program.
Nice to be talking to you, Warren.
Does this sound at all familiar to you?
Yes and no. I mean, all movements are different, as Tolstoy didn't say. Some of the elements are the same, but the proportions, the sequence, the apprehensions, the harumphing, these are present in different measure. But the terms are essentially the same.
What does it say to you about the condition of American politics and society at the moment?
Well, it says to me that the ostensible institutions of reform and governments are more than broken. They're deeply corrupted and locked. And therefore, the energy comes from the outside. That doesn't mean that the outsiders can turn everything over as they like by choosing to try, but it does mean that they have initiative. So we saw it coming from the right a couple of years ago with the Tea Party, and now we're seeing it come from the left. I think that if a Republican had been in the White House, we would have seen this 2 years ago. I'm not bringing you any newsflash when I tell you that there's vast support for the general tenor of this movement, and the notion of 99% is a little bit overdrawn, a little bit wishful, but it's actually more true than not. We have super majorities that favor curbing and controlling the plutocracy. We have large majorities are in favor of progressive taxation of many different kinds. And by the way, I was interested in Justin's report because the first two chants he mentioned hearing today are identical to the two major chants that I heard on the march last Wednesday, October 5th. We are the 99%, and banks got bailed out, we got sold out. So we have a form of coordination here, which is decentral and multi-everything. And it's coalescing around, I think, a general spirit of that the world is really dumping a lot of people over the edge, and that this is impermissible.
So is the left then, after some time of wandering, as it were, and in some respects being co-opted by the institutions of government and politics, finding a new voice?
Well, there's definitely a new voice, or actually voices, because I don't expect that this will simplify into a single strain, or and I don't expect that, that it will be without internal conflicts about how to proceed. That was true in the civil rights movement. That was true in the anti-war movement. It's true in the women's movement. It's true in the gay movement. I mean, there's movements are ragged, are just the way democracy is ragged and unruly. And I don't know any way to anticipate how this is going to play out. It's a new field of action. It's not that there's a new outcome yet, but there's a new field on which to play, and I think it's already made it necessary to heed.
Todd Gitlin, former protest leader on the left in the 60s, now a professor at Columbia University. We'll come back to him. Eric Dezenal is an expert in corporate and political crisis management. He also deals with damage control with Dezenal Resources in Washington. He was in the communications department in the Reagan White House, author most recently of The Devil Himself. Eric Dezenal, good to have you back on our show.
Thanks for having me.
What do you, from your point of view, think about this event at Occupy Wall Street? Do these people have some legitimate grievances? Should the corporate leaders, the people live up there on the Upper East Side, be worried?
Well, I split this one of two ways, and I think some of my view is I understand where some of this is coming from, and then I have a less sympathetic point of view. The sympathetic view is that I remember 2007, I stopped buying stocks, basically because there was a Vanity Fair article that showed these homes for sale in New York, in the Hamptons, going for $40, $60, even $90 million for one lot, and virtually every owner of one of these houses was a Wall Street person. So here I am, an unrepentant capitalist, going, you know, if there is this kind of money being made by not making anything and moving money from here to there, do I really believe in this economy? So from that perspective, I can understand being a young person with facing a country of crushing debt and looking at the way our economic system currently is and being worried, being seriously worried. But then the side is that is less sympathetic, which is we have a generation of people that has come of age reading about the Google guys and Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. And as an employer and as somebody who knows a lot of employers, this is a very difficult generation to get through to, largely because there is an extremely different work ethic. There is a very different sense of expectations. There is an extraordinary high self-esteem and notions of what it is you deserve and deserve right away. And I've been saying to friends who own businesses for years who largely agree that it's only a matter of time before the penny drops. And where I think, and I think what's happening here is frustration, both legitimate and not, is coming forward, is teeming out. As for whether corporations should be concerned, of course corporations should be concerned, because I think that you're dealing with a demonization. I mean, just like I am talking about an entire generation, which it's wrong to grossly overgeneralize, I think that we're seeing a reverse overgeneralization, that corporations are these diabolical people conspiring to hurt people. And, you know, Mitt Romney was not entirely wrong. I think what I would have said is not corporations or people, but corporations are mostly made up of decent, hardworking people trying to make a living.
Okay. Eric Dezenal in corporate and political crisis management. Justin Elliott is still with us, reporter for Salon.com. You're a 20-something. How do you think people of your generation, and particularly those at Occupy Wall Street, would respond to what we just heard from Eric Dezenal?
Well, first of all, yeah, I have to say, as a working 20-something, my feelings are a little bit hurt by his suggestion that my generation is lazy or entitled. I mean, I don't know what to say to his sort of anecdotal evidence for my generation's laziness. But what I can say is, from interviewing people down in Jacoby Park for the last few weeks. Many of these people, those that are unemployed, are looking for decent jobs. I mean, I've seen signs from, you know, young college graduates that just say, I don't have health insurance. They're not trying to be the next Mark Zuckerberg. They're not being lazy. They're, in fact, you know, they're getting out there and participating in democracy. I mean, for years, people are complaining about the apathy of young people in this country, and now young people are getting out there and protesting against economic injustice, against growing income inequality in this country, against bailouts for banks, you know, while there's no relief for the general population. And now we're hearing complaints that they're entitled or lazy. So I don't really understand where he's coming from.
Eric Desenall, as I understand it, unemployment for college graduates who are under 25 is something like 9%, and for high school graduates it's more like almost 20%.
Well, I mean, I think that there are legitimate concerns. I think that, that not everybody who is unemployed wants to be unemployed. I think that if you listen to what my remarks were, I think that there is both a legitimate set of concerns about what's happening to the economy and who's getting the money, but I also believe that that there is a set of expectations that is absolutely extraordinary. And I know a lot of business owners. I don't have a lot of empirical evidence, but it is extremely difficult to deal with people who come in and very, very quickly come in with a series of demands. And this is a hemorrhaging problem. And I think that it doesn't mean that everybody who is of a younger generation has illegitimate concerns, but I just think that it's only a matter of time before there has to be some adjustment to the fact that not everybody is going to be the Google guys or Zuckerberg. And look, nobody likes to be generalized. And I argue with my kids who are of this generation about the same thing. But just like I am making a general statement about a generation of people, I also think that there is a generalization of everybody in the corporate economy that these are all rapacious characters, whereas the vast majority of people get up to work, go every day, and work very, very hard, and work hard for very many years.
Eric Desenall in corporate and political crisis management. Nomi Prinz is a former investment banker, now turned journalist. She's author most recently of Black Tuesday. She's also a senior fellow at Demos. That's a public policy research and advocacy organization based in New York. And Nomi Prinz, good to have you on our show.
Good to have. Thank you very much, Warren.
How do you see this from this between the positions we've heard? Eric Desenall on the one side, Justin Elliott and perhaps Todd Gitlin as well on the other.
Well, yeah, first of all, Justin's doing great reporting. I just want to say that. And, you know, I talked to a lot of colleges as well, trying to connect the dots between how the financial system as it stands and as it has gotten to structurally, foundationally, with its set of very skewed principles of operating, have really crucified the economic futures of, you know, not just the youth of this country, but really, you know, anyone in this country. And I think that's why we see so many people in the streets, not just in New York, but throughout the country. You know, here in L.A., the extra slogan, you know, adding to the other two that were mentioned here, is that, you know, from New York to L.A., make the Wall Street bankers pay. And I don't think that it necessarily means every single person feels that every single, you know, administrative staff person up through, you know, technology guy to Wall Street Bank is necessarily the criminal, but it does imply that Wall Street in general has behaved criminally. The way in which, you know, as Eric was talking about, the homes in the most expensive parts of New York and Long Island are so ridiculously, were in 2007, still are now, out of whack with what anyone else can afford in their rent. And a big reason why people coming out of college with massive amount of debt, you know, have to either live back home, can't find a job. We do have 25% on average unemployment for decent jobs, not because people don't want to work, but because there's no availability. I think that all comes into play, and that's why there is such a diversity of people in the streets of New York and throughout this country and throughout the world that are facing the same sorts of conditions because of the same sorts of practices from the financial infrastructure that we have.
Todd Gitlin, back to you, now professor at Columbia, formerly with the Students for a Democratic Society. Do you see a connection between this and the Arab Spring?
Arab Spring was an inspiration. Many of the Arab uprising people, like in Tunisia as well, as also subsequently in Greece and Spain, are unemployed young people. Of course, their problems are far more grave. But, I mean, it's very different. I do want to respond, though, to the earlier point, which is completely nonsensical, about a generational ill propensity to work. I mean, this is traditionally the harumphing of the property class. Think about this. We're talking here about a generation whose culture cannot be very different than it was 10 years ago. And yet the unemployment rate is about double than it was 2 years ago. So one of two things is logically entailed. Number one, there's been a cultural collapse in the last decade. Or number two, we have a so-called job-creating apparatus that somehow hasn't gotten around to creating jobs. I choose number two.
Eric Desenall, what do you say to that?
I think it's a collision of factors. I don't think it's one thing or the other. And I think that you do. I mean, when I look at what's happening on Wall Street and how money is made, it's very difficult. It's impossible to build an economy by cleverly finding ways to move money from here or there. And I think that aspect of what people are concerned about, I think, is legitimate. But I also believe it is extremely unfashionable to talk about a generation of people that is really quite different than earlier generations. But I think in order for us to get out of this mess, even if that is only one component of it, we're going to have to learn to discuss the fact that this is a very, very real problem in the job market.
How did the generation get to be so different?
Well, I mean, this has been going on for civilizations forever. I think that Saul Bellow referred to it as the swamp of prosperity when he reviewed Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus in the late 50s, that when we get fat and happy, we come to expect things. And I think that we have had a boom economy for so very long that we think of recessions and downturns as something that are temporary blips, where in fact these are down economic times are things that can go on for a very, very long time. And I think we're now seeing something that is to some degree permanent, that it's not like it was in the 90s where every time we got our 401k statement, we all were saying, my God, maybe I could retire when I'm 40. Nobody's saying that anymore. And some of the reasons for that are not the fault, or certainly not the fault of any particular group. But at some point, we do have to look for how we are contributing to this problem, both at the corporate level and the generational level.
So, Nomi Prinz, back to you, former investment banker. Do you agree that this might, in many ways, be a permanent kind of decline, that expectations will necessarily have to be lowered?
I think we're in a decline, and I think expectations should be calibrated to what we can do to change the decline, because there is a particular group, there is a particular element of the financial infrastructure that has contributed to the downfall of the rest of the economy, particularly in the past decade. I mean, student loans, those people who are out in the streets who are graduating from college and not looking at jobs, they're paying significantly more on their student loans than one could even, if they could find it, get a mortgage today. And certainly than the almost 0% that banks are getting today to continue to create nothing, to speculate, to be involved in the global markets, and to back off as if it's not the problem of that mechanism, that the rest of the economy has been decaying. And it has been particularly visceral over the last decade, which is why we are in this, hopefully not new normal, but certainly new long-term period, where the economic prospects of the majority of population are severely, severely limited. There has been, it's not just a wealth distribution up to the top, that is a part of it. It's been a power and influence of the entire global financial and economic structure that has gone on steroids away from anything that looks like economic stability. And there are real reasons and real mechanisms and real practices that made that allow that to happen.
Todd Gitlin, back to you. Do you think that there is hay to be made by the Democrats over what we're seeing with Occupy Wall Street?
I do, and some Democrats seem to think so. Others are embarrassed, and I'm sure there are debates going on in many boardrooms and conference rooms
and congressional cloakrooms, I suspect. What about President Obama with his obvious ties to Wall Street, where he has recently been raising money from which he has drawn some of his principal advisors? He, of course, continued some of the policies of the Bush administration. Is he going to come out looking good or looking bad as a result of this?
Well, I so far I think he's riding it rather well. A blogger characterized his remark last week when asked about the Occupy Wall Street movement as tiptoeing. I think that's accurate. Later in the day, Bill Daley, the chief of staff, wasn't tiptoeing. He was sneering. But yes, Obama is in a fix, and he has to make some delicate and adroit moves now to ride this tide, not be plowed under, and give some of the people who are on the streets, who are, in fact, the Obama movement 08, 3 years later, give them a reason to get excited about reelecting him in 2012. Otherwise, in very big trouble.
Nomi Prinz, originally the Tea Party people were objecting to some of the same things that we hear that are being objected to by Occupy Wall Street. Do you see any possible connection between the two?
Well, certainly in their economics, their own personal economics, I would think most of them, except perhaps the leaders of some of those parties, are exactly the same, whatever their beliefs might be, and they're still in that 99% or whatever it might be, and looking at really dim economic prospects. You know, the way in which the Tea Party sort of characterized, I think, the solutions to some of these same problems, and they were against the bailouts on Wall Street, of course, as well, but their solution was to not have regulation or I'm, again, oversimplifying in this conversation, but and I think, and it isn't a detailed demand at this point of the people protesting right now in Occupy Wall Street, but I think there is a sense of wanting to restrain some of the practices and some of the structural problems that have been caused by the financial industry, in particular Wall Street and so forth, hence Occupy Wall Street. So I think the grievances might be similar, but the connection between the grievances to even the simple to the most complex idea of what could be done or should be done to change them appears to be different.
All right. A lot of things to be talked about, and we will continue the conversation as time goes on. Thanks to all of you. Eric Desenall, formerly in the Reagan administration, now with Desenall Resources in Crisis Management, author most recently of The Devil Himself. Nomi Prinz, Black Tuesday is her book. We didn't get a chance to talk about the Depression. She's a former investment banker turned journalist. Todd Gitlin is professor of journalism, formerly with the SDS, author of The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, and Justin Elliott, our earlier guest, reporter for Salon.com. Thanks, all of you, very much for being with us today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point, Which Way L.A. was produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Katie Cooper, and Carmen Radziner. Our technical director is Phil Richards. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. Join the conversation on Which Way L.A.'s Facebook page. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way L.A. is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.